The court clerk asked them to be upstanding. It is high and formed of 81 opaque glass panels. She counts, trying to impose order. A neat 9 by 9. The sky is a thick grey, bland, oppressive, uninviting, and a blur of a bird flutters above it, a dark smudge mocking the humans below, mocking her husband, granted bail but not granted any real freedom. The limpid light barely filters through, and she craves sunshine and openness, lush green fields, and the quiet contentment of an empty mind. April means they have more than 4 months of this limbo, but now she just wants to get on with it, to put an end to this encroaching sense of dread. She has already had 6 torturous weeks in which to prepare herself and to consider and reconsider her options. 6 weeks of long runs along the Thames and frenzied gym sessions that exhaust her body but not her mind. Long enough to assess and reassess her relationship and to ask herself, what do I really want here? The answer she has fumbled towards, for nothing is a certainty now. Nothing has been certain since that terrible evening in October, is that she wants to keep her family intact. She wants James. Despite the humiliation he has heaped on her, her anger at his infidelity and at his selfishness in putting them through this, she still wants to be with her husband. She has never doubted his innocence, so why would she not be with him? She needs him, of course, and sometimes she hates herself for this dependency. Perhaps it is hardwired into her DNA, this need to hold on to her man, the feeling she knew acutely as a student when she guessed, of course she guessed, that he was unfaithful, whatever he chose to think. Or perhaps it developed when she saw the impact of her father's infidelity, not least the financial insecurity that came when Max left Ginny just before her 50th birthday. All 3 of his daughters had left home, and so there was little financial recompense, despite her choosing to be his wife as her career. Her mother claimed to be perfectly happy, but the former rectory was sold, and she had downsized to a cottage in Devon. Her life was more emotionally stable, with none of those heightened periods of self-loathing that had occurred every time Max had found another woman, and that had characterized Sophie's childhood. But she had lost her home, her social life, and her status. Somewhat reclusive, she lived alone with her dogs, a black Labrador and a liver-coloured Springer Spaniel. Sophie doesn't want that. She's too young to dedicate herself to her children, or to become a country-living eccentric, nor does she want to become the sort of woman her friends shy away from. The attractive divorcee. Never invited to dinner parties for fear she can't be trusted with their husbands. As if her ex-husband's infidelity were contagious, or her neediness and a ruthlessness about remarrying clung like a musky sexuality. Perhaps it would be easier if she had some sort of a career. But she didn't go back to her job as a junior editor in children's publishing after having Emily, the childcare eating up most of her salary. James, whose mother had never worked, more than happy for her to focus on their babies and him. She suspects that was a mistake. Children's literature was the one thing that had interested her in her degree. She had even written a dissertation on the use of menace in Narnia, exploring Lewis's use of the Priapic fawn myth and the theme of abduction. Incredible to think she could write about such a thing. She had briefly hoped that she might stumble upon the next J.K. Rowling, but then she had drifted into preschool literature, where the only jeopardy was the difficulty of pulling on an odd sock, or of finding a lost dinosaur, and it was hard to justify leaving her baby in a nursery to edit such things. Besides, marriage and a family were what she had always wanted. When she was a little girl, she repeatedly painted pictures of herself in a wedding dress. A husband, and a good-looking, high-achieving husband, was on her wish list along with children and a period property with stables for horses and a vast walled garden. It was what she had experienced in her childhood, and what she was brought up to aspire to. Well, she has achieved 2 of the 3. Even at Oxford, finding a husband had been a priority. Perhaps it shouldn't have been. She looks at photographs of herself then, and wonders why she wasted so much time worrying about being alone and obsessing about holding on to James. She was quite a catch, but then he had finished with her at the end of her first year, and they didn't see each other for 7 years. And she had managed. There were other boyfriends, kind, good-looking, fun, who she had finished with when it was clear they weren't husband material. And there were even periods, a couple of months on two occasions, when she was on her own. And she had coped with it. But she hadn't liked it, and, if possible, she doesn't want to have to manage again. James has been her priority for too long. A boyfriend and then husband, whom she knows other women covet, but who chose her, and who has been faithful throughout their marriage before this blip. This terrible, destructive thing that has threatened to rip their marriage apart. Hearing Olivia giving evidence is the thing she fears the most. Having to listen to that bitch detail the event, and hearing her describe their relationship before this happened, for she fears she will be led through all of this by James's barrister. How they met, where they first kissed, how frequently they had sex, whether this was a proper relationship, a 5-month affair, as James had said, rather than a hurried, violent fumble, an uncharacteristic one-off. For James's defence, of course, is that this was consensual sex, sex Olivia agreed to, and which they both sought despite his knowing it was morally reprehensible. Classic woman scorned, a love affair that went wrong, as Chris Clark said in the early days. This isn't rape, but neither was it about love, and it infuriates her that it might be dressed up as this. This, and she thinks she knows her husband well enough to understand this, this was all about sex. Of course she has made James tell her all about it. It was John Vesti, his solicitor, who suggested it. Better that there be no shocks in court, that if she comes, as Chris Clark thinks she should, as she knows she might eventually have to, she will be forearmed, forewarned. And so he has told her the facts of their affair. Where? When? Why? How many times? I see, she said, trying to keep her voice calm. And what about what happened in the lift? The temptation to scream about the fucking lift was almost overwhelming, but she stayed in control, as she always did. She and her children, they were her children at the moment, not his, needed her to stay calm. She imagined a veneer of serenity encasing her, a hard, impenetrable varnish. She hated listening to the answers. His calm assertion that it had been a moment of passion, of madness though entirely consensual. But she made herself sit there, fury wedged tight in her chest. Her eyes burned, but she was too angry to cry. She didn't ask him if he loved Olivia, or if Olivia had ever thought she loved him. She pretended the question was irrelevant, but the truth was, she didn't want to hear.
Chapter 12. Kate. 24th of April, 2017. The courtroom is quiet, quivering with the weighted anticipation that comes in the second before a Wimbledon player serves for the championship, or a fly-half lines up a penalty kick that will win the Rugby World Cup. We've gone through the administration, the choosing of the jury, the organisation of our work desks, the last-minute horse-trading between myself and the defence barrister, Angela Regan, so that we can agree on what can and can't be brought as evidence, and so that there will be no further disclosures at this 11th hour. We've coughed and shuffled and sought to endear ourselves to the judge's clerk, Nikita, a young Asian woman who, by virtue of her closeness to the judge, is one of the most important people in the room. We, with our juniors, Tim Sharples and Ben Curtis, who have done some of the background work, the drafting of statements and liaising with solicitors, and who sit beside us, have marked out our territories, physically, intellectually and legally, as carefully as two tomcats out on the prowl. His lordship, Judge Alad Luckhurst, QC, has spoken to the jury, explaining their responsibility in judging this case. The man being tried, he reminds them, is a high-profile individual whom they may recognise from the newspapers. There are a couple of blank faces at this, the young black guy on the back row, and a grey-haired wisp of a woman dressed as if the past 3 decades have passed her by entirely. But most of the jurors brighten at this news, fresh and alert on this Monday morning at the start of their 2 weeks' jury service. They know full well that James Whitehouse is a junior minister in Her Majesty's government, although they may not have known or cared about his title or role. What they do know is that he is the politician who's accused of raping a colleague in a House of Commons lift. They watch him shrewdly. Does he look like a rapist? What does a rapist look like? He looks less like a politician than one of the new breed of top public school actors. They've struck the jackpot in the lottery of jury service. Short of a trial involving a television celebrity or a gruesome murder, they could not have landed a more interesting or gossip-worthy case. But his lordship suggests they should be impervious to this fact. "We hear a lot about rape at the moment in Parliament and the papers," he intones, his voice more patrician than ever. "We all have prejudices, and you must make sure you do not let prejudice, preconceived ideas or conjecture, influence you in the least." He pauses, letting his words hit home, and though he's said this over 100 times before, the formality of his language and the authority he exudes through his wig, his voice, his position high on the bench on his throne, creates an intensely solemn moment. No one seems to breathe. No paper rustles. "This case must be tried solely according to the evidence." He pauses, and there is that heavy anticipation, that frisson of apprehension and excitement. You can see the enormity of what they're being asked to do, weighing them down. The young Asian man stares, eyes widening. A woman in her 30s looks stricken with fear. His lordship elaborates, explaining that though they may have read about the case in the newspapers or on the internet, they are not to do so from this point, nor, and he looks at them down his nose over half-moon glasses, are they to conduct their own research. Most importantly, they are not to discuss the case outside the jury room, not even with family and friends. He smiles here, for he's a very human judge, one whom I admire and the jury will grow to like. In his early 50s, and so not one of the judiciary who seem divorced from the real world, even if he refers to the internet as if it's to be regarded with suspicion. I suspect he knows more about the net than many of the jurors. He recently presided over a lengthy fraud trial by 2 city bankers, and before that, the trial of a paedophile ring that met in an internet chat room. He knows all about the work of the Criminal Internet Retrieval Unit, which can unearth documents apparently erased from hard drives. And though he may not use WhatsApp and Snapchat himself, preferring to sing in a Bach choir and grow orchids in his spare time, he knows exactly how they work. The jurors smile back at him and nod. These 12 good men and true, though 7 are women. A jury that's not ideal, as women are more likely to acquit a personable man for rape. 2 or 3 are making notes. The rotund man in suit and tie on the far right of the front bench, who I suspect will become the jury foreman, and 2 of the women, both in their 30s, whose gaze flits from the defendant to the judge. An Essex boy, goatee, gelled quiff, cable cardigan, impressive tan, stares at the man in the dock behind me, a hint of menace simmering just below the surface. I look down at my note, hands soft in my lap, and wait for my moment to come. With a nod from the judge, I stand, positioning myself with my head up and my body at ease. My left hand holds my opening speech, at which I will barely glance. My right, a disposable fountain pen with purple ink, my tiny act of individuality to counter the innumerable conventions of the court. I won't need this pen for my speech, but it, and my sheaf of paper are props to prevent me gesticulating wildly. The last thing I must do is fidget and risk distracting the jury or irritating the judge. I hold the judge's gaze, and then I turn to the jurors and make eye contact with them all. I'm going to speak to these people, concentrating on wooing them above anyone else. Like a lover intent on seduction, I will use the tenor and tone of my speech and the way in which I hold their attention to persuade them. I will use every trick in the book. For on this opening day, everything is unfamiliar and disorientating for these jurors. The wigs, the gowns, the language which could come from an 18th-century textbook. My learned friend, your lordship, if I may interject. An issue of disclosure? Well, there it is. I am mindful to suggest an adjournment. Mens rea, the burden of proof. By tomorrow, they'll be used to the canteen, will know where to go to the loo and how long they'll have for a cigarette break. They will realise how hard they will have to concentrate. We'll agree that, as the judge says, 5 hours a day is quite enough for all of us. By then, they will have understood the legal definition of rape and the concept of consent, and their eyes will no longer widen. Their bodies freeze in surprise when words like penis, penetration, oral and vagina are used. But for now, they're keen pupils at the start of the school year, in polished shoes and smart uniforms, with new folders and pencil cases, excited and apprehensive about what the week will entail. And I will settle them in. We'll reassure them that we can do this together, that they will understand the terminology as well as the magnitude of what the British justice system is asking them to do. I won't bamboozle them with law. Most crimes centre around dishonesty, violence and lust. The last two in full play here. Juries sometimes surprise me with the astuteness of their questions, and they will be fully capable of understanding the question at the heart of this trial. At the point of penetration, did James Whitehouse understand that Olivia Lytton did not consent to sex? I begin to speak, still ignoring the man in the box behind me, whose eyes I imagine boring through my black gown, my waistcoat, my tailored shirt, and into the soul of me, by taking heart from the fact that his wife, whom we had thought would be unfailingly supportive, is not in the public gallery high above the court. My voice is low and reassuring, caressing the words, and only interjecting a note of sorrow and indignation when strictly necessary. I reserve my anger for my closing speech. I may need it then. For now, I will be calm and steady. And this is how I start. This case is centred on an event that took place between two individuals. James Whitehouse, who you see behind me in the dock, and a young woman called Olivia Lytton. Mr. Whitehouse, as his lordship has said, may look familiar. He is a member of Parliament, and until he was charged with this offence, a junior minister in the government. He is married with two young children, and Miss Lytton was his parliamentary researcher, who started working for him in March last year. By the May, the two of them had embarked on an affair, despite his being married. It was a consensual relationship, and Miss Lytton believed she was very much in love. The relationship ended on October the 6th, when Mr. Whitehouse told her he needed to be with his family. And that might have been that. Except that on October the 13th, a week after their affair finished, they had sexual intercourse once again in a lift off the committee corridor in the heart of the House of Commons. There is no dispute that this event took place. Both sides acknowledge that. What is in dispute is the nature of it. Was this, as the Crown submits, something sinister? An act forced upon Miss Lytton by the defendant? Was it, in fact, a rape? Or was it, as the defence will submit, an act of passion, a frenzied bout of lovemaking by two individuals caught up in the moment. You will hear evidence from both sides, but for you to reach this verdict, you must agree on three things. One, did penetration by a penis take place? The answer is yes. Neither side disputes this. Two, at the point of penetration, did Miss Lytton consent? And three, at the point of penetration, was Mr. Whitehouse aware that Miss Lytton did not consent? I pause and push my heavy-rimmed glasses up my nose, then look at the jury, managing eye contact with each and every one of them, trying to impress upon them that they must concentrate, but simultaneously to reassure them that they can do this. I smile, as if to say that this is simple. It really is no more complicated than that. Chapter 13, the 25th of April, 2017. Day 2, and Olivia Lytton, the complainant in the language of the court, the blonde mistress, as she was once described by the Sun, enters the witness box. The jury falls quiet, for my opening was the warm-up. Olivia is the main event as far as we are all concerned. A couple of the women stare at her, eyes narrowed. The elderly woman, who had looked as if she had no knowledge of the case yesterday, is peering at her through wire-rimmed glasses, and one of the 30-somethings, straightened hair, heavy brows, foundation troweled so that her face is an orangey pink, is perfecting a scowl. She's one of the women who've been glancing at the defendant in the dock, as if she cannot quite believe that he's there, almost as if she's starstruck. I keep my gaze neutral, and when she catches my eye, give her a bland, business-like smile. Olivia looks terrified. Her eyes glimmer, the possibility of tears not far off, and her skin has an unnatural pallor, as if her spirit and not just her blood has been drained. When I met her in the witness room yesterday, she spoke clearly and quickly, betraying her intelligence, her anxiety, and a simmering anger. She was brittle, holding her body stiffly like a fragile twig about to break. "The odds are against us, aren't they?" she said, rattling off some statistics about conviction rates in a direct challenge. "We've got a strong case, and I aim to persuade the jury he's guilty," I said, looking her in the eye and trying to convey the strength of my determination, not just the CPS's, to acquire a conviction. She smiled weakly, her mouth twisting to one side, a look of sad resignation that said, "But that's not enough, is it?" She's a Cambridge graduate and not stupid. But you don't need to be clever to acquire her knowledge. Being raped will soon erode your belief in fairness and justice and being treated with respect. In court, though, there is no hint of such brutal awareness, and she looks the picture of innocence, or at least more innocent than you might imagine a young woman in her late 20s who's embarked on an affair to appear. She's wearing a simple shift dress with a Peter Pan collar, and I wondered if this was pushing it too far, but it works well. She's sufficiently slim to pull off the androgynous, waif-like look, and it has desexualized her body. Those small breasts, bitten and grabbed, the crown will submit, are swamped by navy fabric, her long legs obscured by the stand. No glimpse of anything that could be perceived as overtly, tantalizingly sexual here. James Whitehouse can't see her, of course. The stand is cordoned off so that she can be seen by the jury, the judge and counsel, but not by the defendant. There's a move towards using video evidence of vulnerable witnesses in sexual assault cases. The complainant's testimony, relayed in grainy black-and-white images that flicker and jump like a crudely edited amateur video as it lurches between the disturbing and the mundane. Olivia could also be questioned via video link, but has bravely agreed to give evidence in court. That way, the jury can sense the full trauma of the ordeal. We'll catch each intake of breath, spot her shoulders shake. And though it will be distressing and might seem cruel, It is in the spaces between her words, the silences that swell as she fumbles for a tissue or responds to his lordship's suggestion that she has a sip of water, that her story will emerge most clearly. It is through this vivid and compelling evidence that we have the best hope of convicting him. I watch the jurors watching her now, assessing her dress, the shine of her hair, trying to read into her expression, distinctly apprehensive, though she is trying so hard to be brave. She catches my eye, and I smile, hoping to convey my reassurance, to let her know that she will survive this, that it will be bearable, if not okay. I know that she's preparing to relive the most horrific event of her life, with all its intense shame, anger, and fear. It takes real courage to do this, to stand up in court and accuse someone you once loved of this vicious crime. And she may feel guilt at this apparent betrayal. I imagine her palms pricking with sweat, her underarms growing damp as the court clock ticks, regular and insistent, marking the silence. She's about to reveal herself as emphatically as if she were cut to the bone. I wonder if she's thinking of him behind the screen, if she imagines his gaze focused in her direction. She sounds intensely nervous. Her voice, that of her home county Sloane, so quiet that when she confirms her name, I have to ask her to speak up. "Olivia Clarissa Lytton," she says more firmly, and I smile and turn to the jury. Ms. Orangeface's eyebrows have shot up. Yes, we all know it's a ridiculously posh name, but don't hold that against her. Rape, like domestic violence, happens across all classes. Could happen to each and every one of us. Miss Lytton, I'm going to ask you some questions, and we're going to take things slowly. Now, if you could just keep your voice up a little. I try to settle her in, maintaining eye contact and smiling encouragement, trying to make her comfortable. It's important. An uneasy witness won't tell their story well, and there's little worse than a witness with a suddenly blank mind. I phrase my questions simply and ask them one at a time, leading on things like date, location, time and names, but otherwise allowing her to talk about the events at her own speed and in her own words. I develop a rhythm. Question, answer, question, answer, maintaining an even tempo as if we were going for a gentle afternoon's walk, and a single fact was being thrown down with each step. When did you start working for Mr. Whitehouse? In March. And what was your role in his office? Did you enjoy it? And what did that entail? Short, easy questions that are uncontentious and that allow me to lead her, a little, because they're not in dispute, and Angela Regan, a formidable advocate, will not need to bluster and interject. And I think that when Mr. Whitehouse gained his ministerial job, you still worked for him in his Commons office? Yes, that's right. And so we go on. We hear a little about the long hours she was expected to work and the general culture within this and the departmental office. They all respected Mr. Whitehouse, the civil servants calling him Minister, though he preferred James. Was he friendly? Yes, but not overly so. Did you socialise together? I give her a smile. Patrick and Kitty, the staff in the private office, and I would sometimes go for a drink, but James never did. And why was that? He had a heavy workload, or he would say he needed to go home to see his family. His family. I pause. Let the fact that he's a married man with two young children just hang in the air. But all that changed, didn't it? I go on. Yes. On May the 16th, you did go for a drink together. Yes. I think you'd been for a drink with friends earlier. I pause and smile to reassure her that I'm not revealing anything shocking. We all go for the odd drink, my demeanour and my calm, no-nonsense tone says. We established that she'd had a couple of gin and tonics with former colleagues from Conservative Central Office at the Marquis of Granby, and that feeling a little light-headed, she went back to the Commons just before 10 p.m. to pick up a forgotten gym bag. And it was while she was walking through New Palace Yard that she met James Whitehouse. That's marked A on the first map in your folders, the outside space between Portcullis House and Westminster Hall, I tell the jury, holding a document up. There's a rustling of papers, an increase in interest on the jurors' faces as they open their ring binders of evidence and search for the map. Everyone loves a map, even though there's no real need for anyone to look at one at the moment. But I want the jurors to visualise Olivia and James meeting at this point they see marked with an X on a map in their ring binders. They need to get used to the physical layout of the Commons, a labyrinth of back passages and secret corridors that lends itself to illicit meetings, both political and sexual. I want to plant the seed of this idea now. And what happened next? Did you speak to him? I ask. Yes, Olivia says, and her voice wobbles. I look at her sharply. She can't turn flaky now. We're not close to the meat of the evidence. I smile encouragingly, though my smile contains a hint of steel. I saw him coming towards me, so I said, hello, and I stumbled a bit. I think I was nervous. The house wasn't sitting, and I hadn't expected to see him. I was just rushing to collect my bag. And what happened when you stumbled? He helped me. He sort of held my upper arm to steady me, and then he asked if I was all right. Something like that. And had he ever helped you like that, held your upper arm before? No, he'd never touched me. It was all quite proper in the office. Did he carry on touching your arm? No, he dropped it once I'd got my shoe back on. And what happened then? I continue. Any slightly tipsy young woman might scurry away. But that's not what happened here. I can't lead her on that, though. Must wait for her to place the next piece in the jigsaw of her story. She smiles, and her voice quivers at the memory. He asked me for a drink. I lead her on. Question, answer, question, answer, maintaining the rhythm, keeping things slow, even and pleasant, pacing my speed to match the movement of the judge's pen. We confirm that the relationship started, and that after a week it was consummated. Ms. Orangeface narrows her eyes further. They had sex, yes. That is what this case is about. Get over it. I don't convey this irritation, of course. I remain serene, my gaze moving from one juror to another, but not settling on any of them for any length of time. I'm too busy drawing out my chief witness, who's grown in confidence. She stands more at ease now, her voice no longer so high-pitched. I don't want her to go into details of this relationship. That will only open her up to Angela questioning her about their previous sexual history, something, the Crown submits, that's totally irrelevant. We've agreed on a series of set words to convey that it happened, and now it's time to move on to what happened in the lift. But Olivia resists keeping it this factual and clear-cut. I didn't want it to end. She adds, when I ask her to confirm the relationship was finished on the 6th of October. Her voice drops to a near whisper. Her curtain of hair swings in front of her face. I don't ask why this was, and am preparing to move on, but she seems determined to be heard on this. She tilts her head up, her hair swishing against her cheek. Her eyes are moist, but her voice rings out, clear in the simplicity of her statement. I didn't want it to end, because I was in love with him.
Chapter 14. Sophie. The 25th of April, 2017. Sophie is shaking. In the sanctity of her home, she has begun shaking. her body betraying her in a way it would never do in public. Limbs knocking together, jangling, undermining her habitual self-control. Her stomach falls out of her as soon as she reaches the downstairs loo, handbag thrown on the floor, its contents splayed across the Edwardian tiles. Lipstick, purse, diary, mobile phone. The phone's face shatters with the sudden drop, a slim line running in a neat diagonal, then dispersing into tiny shards just held by the cover's tension. Gathering the items together, she traces the line with her finger, entranced and unthinking, then winces at the pain caused by a tiny sliver of glass. She begins to weep, her shoulders hunched around her, the sobs muted until she reaches her bedroom. For Christina might be in her room on the next floor, and she cannot bear her gentle, insistent support. The au pair has been so eager to show her sympathy. Those tremulous brown eyes threatened to overflow with tears as she left with the children for school this morning, and Sophie wanted to scream at her to pull herself together, to show some self-restraint in front of the children as she was having to do, as she continually had to do. Where was the self-absorption she had expected from a teenage girl, and that they had experienced with Olga, their previous au pair, who would empty the freezer of Ben and Jerry's, scooping the ice cream straight from the tub into her vast, gaping mouth, and then put the near-empty carton back? Christina has witnessed the whole unfolding of this hideous mess, was at home that night back in October, when the story broke, has lived with them through the doorstepping by the paparazzi that first terrible weekend, and even, bless her, opening the front door and lying on her behalf. "Mrs. Whitehouse and the children are not in," she told one photographer, who was more insistent than any of the others, hanging around after James had gone into Westminster on the Monday and laying siege to them in their own home. And she and Emily and Finn had hidden upstairs in Em's bedroom at the back of the house, as this slight 18-year-old, with her charming French accent, deviated from the instructions she had given her. "Just tell them we're not here, then close the door politely but firmly," and began to beseech them, her voice spiralling in indignation. "Please, please, Mrs. Whitehouse is not here. Please, can you just leave them alone?" She listens now, a sob in her throat. "Christina," she calls up to her bedroom. Silence. Her body aches with the relief, the utter relief of being on her own. She shuts the bedroom door and leans against her radiator, feeling the warmth seep into her back, pulling her knees up and holding them tight towards her, as if she is being held tight and warmed. As if, she acknowledges, as she gives herself up to the shaking that courses through her body, so that her knees knock against one another uncontrollably again, she is back in the womb. She lets herself sit like this for a good 5 minutes, the tears tracing lines down her cheeks though her sobs remain muted. Having spent 40 years learning to control her emotions, she feels self-conscious, and yet the relief of letting go. She reaches for a tissue and blows her nose noisily, swiping at her wet cheeks, then risking looking in the mirror to find her face blotched, red, streaked with mascara. She looks a mess. She walks to the bathroom, splashes herself with cold water, and reaches for the cleanser. Laboriously sweeps away the detritus of the morning. Mascara, foundation, eyeliner, fear, guilt, shame, and this intense, gnawing sorrow, with a large, flat cotton wool pad. Pats her skin dry, applies moisturizer. Stares blankly at a face that is no longer the one she knows, or, rather, one she would rather not recognize. Begins the process of constructing it, and herself, once more. She had gone to the court in disguise, and left just after Olivia said that she was in love with her husband. After she prompted a little hush of sympathy, some of the jurors looking rapt as her voice, fraught with emotion, rang out around the court. James didn't know she was going to be there. After the pre-trial hearing, she told him she wouldn't attend, that she couldn't bear to sit, hearing the evidence. Whatever Chris Clark might deem necessary for his political rehabilitation after the case had come to an end.
"You can't not stand by him."
The Director of Communications had been incandescent, spitting tiny globules of phlegm.
"I am standing by him, but I don't have to sit there lapping it all up," she had said. "Besides, if I'm there, it will just mean another picture."
Chris, his face flushed an unhealthy red, had grunted and conceded, with visible reluctance, that she had a point. She was surprised by the intensity of her fury, and by the inner strength that surged up inside her at their insistence.
"The trouble with women," James once told her, making the sort of sweeping generalization he would never make in front of female colleagues but did at home, "is that they lack the courage of their convictions. Mrs. Thatcher aside, they don't have our self-belief."
Well, she had stood firm on this. James was disappointed. That was his word, said with cold eyes and a certain sanctimony, although what he had to be sanctimonious about, and here a surge of anger reignited, she did not know, but, of course, he respected her decision. How could he not? He loved her, wouldn't want her to suffer any further humiliation, and perhaps, in the end, he was relieved. For just as he had refused to see her in the full throes of labour, for fear it would affect their sex life, perhaps he thought it would kill it entirely if she had to hear every detail of his relationship with another woman. Because how could any relationship survive hearing the most intimate details of another like this? You can survive infidelity if you can convince yourself, time and again if necessary, it need not be repeated. She knew this because her mother had lived with her father, because James had been repeatedly unfaithful when they first went out. She had refused to acknowledge it, ignoring the smirks of those girls who thought they might drag him from her, never once confronting him, for that would force him to make a choice between them. And you can survive repeated infidelities, she knew, if you can tell yourself that these affairs are devoid of emotion, that they are purely physical, and that it is you, and only you, whom your husband loves. But can your marriage survive if you are forced to listen to every detail of the liaison? If that relationship is picked apart like roadkill ripped by carrion, and if your marriage is then put under the spotlight, its flaws, its robustness implicitly questioned, and found wanting after all? If you learned that another woman loved your husband and, worse, that she believed he loved her, or at least that he had intimated he felt something... For a 5-month affair with a colleague, with whom he works closely and whom he admits he admired, is not a one-night stand. Is not entirely devoid of emotion. Not if it's conducted by someone like James, who can be ruthless, yes. And she thinks of his cocktail eyes, his tendency to analyze a room and assess who will be the most interesting, the most useful, and to extricate himself from less helpful conversations. But who can also be so very tender? Could her marriage survive her listening to all this? Her hearing that it wasn't just her whom he made love to, really made love to, or that the sex, even the rough sex, for that was how she thought of this allegation, reflected the sex that she had had with him? That there were distinct parallels between the way in which he kissed, sucked, tweaked, played with them both, and that the most intimate part of her relationship was not as unique as she had always thought it. That their relationship, the thing that she had always put first, before even, and this shamed her now, her children, was not as special as she had once thought. The risk of discovering this is what made her dig her heels in, and insist she stay away. That, and the inevitable humiliation, the prospect of being scrutinized by judge and jurors and those in the public gallery, a peculiar mix of law students, foreign tourists and day-trippers who have discovered that they might find more compelling drama here in this courtroom than at home on their television screens. She has always been lucky. Someone whose life has been as bright and solidly precious as a fat gold ingot. Her middle name is Miranda, she who must be admired, and she has taken it for granted that this is the most apt of names.
but in the past 6 months her luck has deserted her, and the admiration she has long accepted has been replaced by an almost gleeful pity. The envy she is used to, which peaked when James was elected and started taking the children to school once a week, has curdled into faux sympathy and outright suspicion. The coffee morning invitations have dried up, and she was asked to leave the PTA ball committee in case the substantial sums fundraised petered out. The stream of requests for playdates with her children has abruptly stopped, and if this has sapped her self-esteem, corroded her spirit, hurt far more than she has admitted, then how much worse to have to endure this humiliation in court. And yet, when it came to it, she could not keep away. The desire to hear what happened and to understand what her husband was up against became physically overwhelming, a sharp pain to be coughed from her chest that could not be contained. And so she did something entirely uncharacteristic. Pulled a wool beanie on her head, dressed down in trainers and jogging bottoms, and thrust on the horn-rimmed glasses which James despised, and which she only wore when she made the long drive to Devon. Dressed like this, she had gone there and hidden herself away. Unlike the pre-trial hearing, when she had marched to the court entrance, clutching James's hand and braving the throng of photographers, she slipped straight to the queue for the public gallery and waited with a couple of broad-shouldered, bomber-jacketed black youths who talked of their friend's previous stretch and predicted his next sentence in language she could only guess at.
"A four, man? Nah, a two."
The larger cracked his knuckles and bounced on his toes, testosterone and adrenaline firing from him, his energy so contagious she couldn't help watching, even though she was trying to avoid their attention.
"Yo, phone."
She started as he pointed to her electronic device, his voice a disarmingly sexy bass, his gaze not provocative but serious.
"You can't take your phone into court. You need to leave it outside."
And she, having forgotten, felt ashamed, for he was chivalry itself, once she stopped behaving as if he was to be feared, and directed her to the travel agent down the street, where you could leave your gadgets for £1, and where, he told her enthusiastically, he had left his. In the end, she only managed half an hour of listening to Olivia. Perched high in the public gallery, with a group of American law students whose terrorism trial had been adjourned, she was unable to see her, though she knew her from the papers and from previous news footage. A tall, sylph-like figure, a blonde version of herself, or herself as she had been 15 years ago. She could hear her, though, and sensed her through every catch of her voice, and through the jurors' reactions. Intrigued, scandalized, and then sympathetic as she told of how she had fallen in love. And she had watched her husband, apparently forgotten in the dock, but listening intently to every word that Olivia said, and occasionally taking a note that he would hand to his solicitor. And then Olivia confirmed details of when their relationship had started and ended, and she remembered assuming that James was just working late. And suddenly, the air was oppressive, and she was pushing past the American girls' long denimed legs and their big white sneakers, mouthing apologies as they glanced up at her, bemused, desperate not to be noticed by the court as she tried to open the oak door to the gallery silently and managed to slip away. She hailed a black cab on Ludgate Hill after retrieving her phone, and now she was here, safe, back home. Her experiment in watching the case incognito apparently not rumbled, but she is still filled with a profound sense of shame. She doesn't know how she can ever go back, how she can sit in court and listen as the evidence grows more explicit, the details more murky. For that is what she is going to have to confront, isn't it? The fact that her husband, her loving husband who adores their children and is almost universally admired, will be accused of something indecent, something abusive, something she does not want to hear. A rape, for goodness sake. The worst crime she can conceive of apart from murder.
and cannot make fit with her knowledge of him.
She starts to throw clothes into a hold-all. Ridiculous, she knows, and yet the fight-or-flight reflex is kicking in properly. She cannot stay here, in her tasteful bedroom with its muted greys and whites, its Egyptian cotton with a high thread count and its touches of cashmere, with its clean, clear surfaces for what James calls her unguents and potions, and her collection of jewellery, pared down, with the heirlooms from her grandmother hidden away. "Let's have a bedroom like a hotel room," her husband once said, making a rare foray into her realm, their home's interior design. "It will feel more decadent, more naughty." And he had snaked a hand up the front of her shirt. Now she wonders which hotel rooms he was thinking of, and with whom he spent time there. She races to the children's rooms, heart jabbering away, a tight hammer striking against her ribcage. Wrenches drawers open and empties them of jeans, tops, hoodies, pants and socks, pyjamas, a couple of books, favourite soft toys. In the bathroom she scoops up toothbrushes and toiletries, then Calpol, Benlin, ibuprofen. From the hall, three pairs of wellies, her walking boots, hats, gloves, waterproofs, waxed jackets. In the kitchen, children's water bottles, fruit, and the sort of contraband that is usually rationed. Crisps, cereal bars, bags of sweets left over from parties, chocolate biscuits. At the fridge she pauses, then unscrews a white wine bottle, and very deliberately takes a large, hard swig. By 3:30 p.m. she is parked in prime position outside the children's school, the nose of her car pointing westwards. The roads will become gridlocked in the run-up to rush hour, and she wants to whisk them away. She checks herself in the mirror, and notices that her eyes are alight with what she hopes Emily will interpret as excitement, but which she recognises as adrenaline. In the lines crinkling at the corners, dehydrated from lack of sleep, roughened by crying, she can read only fear and pain. Finn flies out first, his face breaking into a smile as he barrels into her legs, a small ball of passion.
"Why is Christina not picking us up?"
Emily, bag knocking against her ankles, is more circumspect.
"Because I am,"
she smiles.
"Come on, get in the car." "Where's Daddy? How was his day in court?"
She pretends not to hear as she herds them into the 4x4, negotiating a route through her one-time friends, those feline-eyed mummies who cannot help but look up, ears pricked, eyes glinting, as Emily's too bright voice rings out loud and clear.
"Not here, darling,"
she mutters, almost jogging to the car, and resisting the temptation to be curt. She makes her voice honeyed.
"Here we are. In we go, then."
Her hands are shaking as she thrusts the key fob into the ignition and starts the car. Her pupils, caught in the mirror, are giant buttons. She has a distinct sense of observing herself, of knowing, objectively, that she is too hyped to be embarking on a long journey with two young children, and yet realising that she has to do it anyway. She takes a quick swig of a water bottle, the liquid spilling down her chin and a wet beard, flicks the indicator, and draws away. A shining black tank of a car, all chrome bumper, gloss and anger, blares as she pulls in front of it. She swerves, narrowly avoiding a crash, and holds up her hand in apology.
"Mum!"
Emily's voice escalates into a cry.
"I'm doing my seatbelt!"
"I'm sorry!" She is as close as she ever comes to shouting. Her voice wavers.
"I'm so very sorry, okay?"
The car thrums with silence.
"Mummy?"
Finn asks at last, as they crawl onto the main artery out of West London, and then up and away, leaving the tower blocks and all uncertainty behind them.
"Where are we going?"
She feels the tension begin to ease from her for a second, for she has predicted this question, and has prepared her answer.
"On an adventure," she says.
Chapter 15. Holly. The 16th of January, 1993. The college library smelled of books, a smell that was dry and sweet, as if the scent of parchment had been distilled to that of clean, crisp straw. It didn't smell like a bookshop, a place in which the scent of the books was muddled by the rain on customers' coats, or the fug that they brought with them, the tuna sandwich gobbled on entering the shop and quietly belched, or the beer, still warm on the breath, that had been swilled at the King's Arms moments before. When Holly first entered the mid-17th century library, it was the scent of these books that struck her. A smell unmarred, except by a hint of instant coffee that wafted from the chief librarian's sturdy pottery mug. Next, it was the books themselves, stretching from the thickly carpeted floor almost all the way up to the barrel-vaulted ceiling. Its panels painted the delicate pale pink of a baby's fingernail, and a soft mint green divided with gold and studded at each intersection with a white ceiling rose. There were 10 shelves or more of these books, reaching all the way up each bookshelf from the leather-bound encyclopedic tomes at the bottom to the paperback textbooks that you needed a wooden ladder to access, the struts creaking as you shifted your weight on the way to the top. There were 16 bays in all, each lined with these shelves and divided into English literature, French, German, and Italian, ancient Greek and Latin, philosophy, politics and economics, geography, theology, music, history of art, law. History had its own college library as if the subject matter was so immense it could not be contained within these shelves. She didn't know if the chemists, biochemists and mathematicians borrowed textbooks, but she rarely saw them here, and imagined that most of their knowledge was gained not in such a quiet, studious space, but in the forensic environment of a lab. It was early morning, 8:30, one of her favourite times of the day when the library was almost empty, only herself and the chief librarian, Mr. Fuller, a scurrying figure she nicknamed Mr. Tumnus, after the fawn in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, who emanated tension if a student dared to talk loudly or, worse still, entered the library to find a friend, not a book. He liked her, though. She watched, as he gave her a quiet nod, and then busied himself with a set of small oak drawers in which the books were indexed, the authors alphabetized, and then the titles. The university library, the BOD, had an electronic catalogue, but these things took time, and there was no hurry here for such a system. Though the books were pristine, a soft layer of dust coated the screen of the library computer. Order was preserved by index cards, some yellowed, with the titles typed 50 years earlier, others handwritten. The system had worked for 100+ years, and there seemed no need for it to be altered. There was still a role for those small oak drawers. The librarian trod briskly down the carpeted corridor to shelve returned books and to rearrange a pile pulled out overnight and then abandoned. But apart from the tread of his brogues and intermittent tusks at the apparent selfishness of the students, the library was silent. Just Holly and those tens of thousands of books. She stretched out, enjoying the shaft of sunlight that streamed through the vast east-facing window beside her and dappled her notepad. Motes of dust dancing in the brightness, the shadow of the traceried stonework demarcating her book. A staircase crisscrossed inside the windows of the college on the other side of the square, and she spied the smudge of a figure running down it and wondered, yet again, at the exquisite beauty of this place, and at its mystery. All those lives, all those stories being played out alongside each other in libraries, dining rooms and boathouses, bars and nightclubs, museums, gardens, even punts. If university was a place of discovery, then there were thousands of lives being reinvented or found, narratives written and rewritten, sexualities tried and discarded, political allegiances tested, altered, and abandoned over the length of an 8-week term. The freshers who smiled proudly for their first formal group photo were not the same students who threw their mortarboards into the air and pelted one another with eggs and flour, some self-consciously, some with a sheer thrill of relief as they left the exam schools 3 years later. Life, intellectual, social and sexual discovery would have embraced them all. And she was ready for all this. Already, just one term in, she could feel herself altering, her accent softening as if the warmer Oxfordshire climate was melting her lilting cadences, her self-belief increasing as she left.